Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
All right, everyone, welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. We have a great episode in store for you today. I'm Nina Pantic, and Irina Falcone will be on in just a second. Our special guest is former ATP pro and CEO of Tennis Evolution, Jeff Salzenstein. Jeff was an excellent junior in Colorado before going to Stanford, where he'd end up playing number one. After school, he gave himself 3 years to make it as a pro, but serious ankle and knee injuries ruined that plan. Instead of quitting, he kept chasing his dreams and would win 5 ATP Challenger titles and reach a career-high ranking of exactly number 100 in 2004. The feat made him the first ever American to break into the top 100 at the age of 30. After retiring a few years later, he put all of his focus into coaching back home in Colorado. In 2010, he started Tennis Evolution, an online destination for tennis lessons and coaching videos. Every day, he uses his decades of playing and coaching experience to help players of all ages and abilities in Colorado and all over the world online. Okay, listeners, it's time to meet Jeff Salzenstein. Okay, Jeff, welcome to our show. It's awesome to have you on. Tell us where you're at in the world and how you're doing.
Yeah, thank you so much for bringing me on today. I'm in Denver, Colorado, coming from my green room here. And I'm from Denver, moved back to Denver after I started playing pro tennis. And now I'm trying to help as many people as I can through the interwebs get better at tennis.
So Denver, there's a lot of high altitude there. It's not the easiest place, I would say, to play tennis at. Mm-hmm. How did you decide, like, okay, I'm just going to stick with Denver, even though, is there a huge tennis population there?
Sure. So I think we got to go back in time a little bit. And when my parents split up when I was 5 years old, I moved to Denver with my mother. And, that's where her family was from. And I had the tennis bug. My father played Division I college tennis at Mighty University of Northern Colorado. And I just played tennis at a young age. And so I grew up in Denver. I was a public high school kid. I didn't go to an academy. I like to joke, I spent 1 week with Rick Macy in Greenleaf, Florida, before he moved to South Florida. I spent 1 week there. I played a practice match against Jennifer Capriati when I was 14 and remember all the top juniors there. But after a week at an academy format set up, I was like, I can't do this. I got to live at home. So, I grew up in a relatively normal household, blended family. And so when I stopped playing professional tennis, I was 33. And I was at that crossroads that a lot of pro athletes are in. Here I was, a Stanford graduate, and had no idea what I was going to do with the rest of my life. It was a very scary time. And situations kind of created a dynamic where it was the best move for me to come back to Denver, to come back home, and started coaching. And that's what you do when you've never had a real job before. I started coaching. And yeah, I mean, I thought about this, that I could go to Florida or Texas or California, or maybe work with top pros, but I chose lifestyle first over anything else. And so have been able to carve out a nice lifestyle that I enjoy in Denver. I love this community. I love this state, but it's certainly not a tennis hotbed. We're not churning out players. There aren't a lot of players coming to find me in the hinterlands out here. Interestingly enough, very weak on the junior side, but on the adult side, after Atlanta, Georgia, it's the second, most popular USTA league setup at Denver after Atlanta. So it's a sneaky adult league tennis town. But on the junior side, it's definitely not very strong.
But you were a very, very good junior, and then you went to Stanford where you worked way up to number one. But we want to talk about this pro career of yours. Did you always want to go pro when you were a kid? I mean, talented juniors kind of always have it in their heads. Did you?
No, again, I mean, I was raised that academics were very important. you know, that was what we were focusing on in my household. And I happened to be a good national junior at 12. I won the nationals, but at 15, I had dropped all the way to 69 in the country. I was triple crowned at Kalamazoo, which means you lose first round singles, doubles, and back draw. So if you're almost 16 years old and you're getting triple crown at Kalamazoo, you're not going to play pro tennis. That was not part of the plan. And so, I recalibrated. I was a late bloomer. I grew. I finally went through puberty at like 17 or 18. I caught up to some of the other players and got my ranking up high enough so that Dick Gould happened to notice me. And so that was the path. My dream, I remember at 12 years old, my dream was to go to Stanford. That was the premier school. They were churning out pros, but playing at the next level, it was like this big dream, but I didn't think it was possible coming from Denver. So I went to college, had a crappy serve, couldn't break 100 miles an hour, played number five singles my freshman year. I was on my way to being a part of a tech startup or a lawyer or a finance guy. And then I grew 3 inches in college. I added 20 miles an hour to my serve. And next thing you know, I was kind of a power player all of a sudden. So kind of like a mini Annie Roddick when he was a junior and he developed a big game. It's kind of what happened to me at the level I was playing at. And so that gave me an opportunity to try the pro tour after I graduated.
Wow, that's awesome. So what did you major in Stanford? I mean, you said that you were on your way for the lawyer tech startup thing. So what'd you major in?
Well, I majored in tennis. That was what I did most. But on the academic side, I was an economics major. And my career kind of took off in college. My sophomore year, I jumped to play number two. My last 2 years, I played number one. And so my junior year is when I actually thought, wow, I'm gonna give the pro tour about 3 years, give it a shot. And so, you know, grateful that I went 4 years, that I got my degree, that I have an economics degree, but I can't say that I knew what I was going to do with that in the real world once I started life after college.
It's fair.
Out of college and you hit the pro tour, how did you find the pro tour grind right away? I know that you had some injuries in the 3 year gap that you gave yourself to make it, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's stories upon stories of my journey. And that's one of the things I'm so passionate about as a coach is, you know, I have that perspective of the adversity, the injuries, the setbacks that I think I can bring to students and clients, you know, on the tennis side and also in the high performance side. So my junior year, I got to the semis of the NCAAs and our team won the national championship. We had an undefeated year with Scott Humphries, who had won Junior Wimbledon the year before. He came in as a freshman. Paul Goldstein, he won 15 Kalamazoos, I think. I think he won three or four in a row. And so we had an undefeated season. And after that year, I actually thought about turning pro. I was like top five in college that year, got to the semis, but I decided to come back because my family was like, what are you doing? You've gone 3 years. You might as well just go the fourth and get your degree. So I came back my senior year and it was a really tough year because of the expectations and the uncertainty of what was next. And my senior year was not as good as my junior year. I lost first round singles of the NCAAs, even though we upset UCLA, your alma mater, in the finals of the team championship. We came out of nowhere to beat them. But when I turned pro, I remember this distinctly. It was, you know, we graduate in June, we're on the quarter system. And my kind of manager at the time was advising me on my schedule. And he said, listen, don't play the USTA circuits because it's like dog eat dog. It's so rough. We're going to send you overseas or over the border in this case. So I go to Mexico to play in a satellite, my first tournament ever. And I fly into Mexico City and I get on a bus and I go to Puebla, Mexico. I don't know if you guys have been to gals have been to Puebla before, but it's like 8,000 feet. You can see the volcano, you know, from the courts. You're playing with pressureless balls, which are different than the ones we use in Colorado. And I was playing a guy from Guatemala that was about 5'6", and he was ranked 750 in the world. And the court was slanted like this. This is my first pro match after playing at Stanford in front of 5,000 people in the Georgia, in Athens in Georgia. And it was just incredible. And nobody's watching. And I lose 4-1 in about an hour and 5 minutes. And I come off the court as the Stanford All-American going, what did I just get myself into? I'm in big trouble here. And so there was panic mode that week, that first week in Puebla. But I recalibrated and ended up getting to the finals the next 3 weeks and finished second in that satellite. And then got a wild card. I remember I got a wild card into Indianapolis. That was the RCA at the time. I won my first round and lost to Mark Woodford. So I got some points there. And then in October, I went over to Portugal. Same deal. Instead of playing in the US, I went to Portugal. I played all these dirt ballers on a hard court in Portugal for 4 weeks, and I won that satellite. And so that was kind of my springboard, having two good results in two foreign countries and kind of getting my ranking up around 300 in about 4 months. So luckily, you know, my transition wasn't that first year wasn't that tough. It was the next year getting from 150 in the world to try to break the top 100. That was the bear for me. That was the thing that I really had a hard time with.
Yeah, the sophomore year is always the toughest. But I got to ask, so you lose 4-1 to the Sky in Puebla, Mexico, and then you go and you do remarkably well the following 3 weeks. Was there something that changed? Did you talk to someone? Because I mean, that's a big shift. And you said you went into panic mode. I just want to know, I'm just curious, where did your mind go after that?
Yeah, well, obviously, the initial was panic. Like, what am I doing? Am I good enough? You know, if I can't beat a guy that's 750 in the world, how am I going to make it out here? Those were the initial thoughts. But I think, you know, I probably talked to my parents, you know, my stepfather, super grounded guy, my father, also my mother too. I mean, I was raised in a very grounded environment. I would say, you know, again, pretty functional situation. So I kind of had that backbone even as a kid. You know, I won a bunch of sportsmanship awards. My stepdad wrote me a poem when I was 12 about what it means to be a champion and to play with character and integrity. And so I think I had that foundation. So when the you know what hit the fan, I had the ability to bounce back. And I think that, you know, obviously all great players or good players that end up having success, they're the ones that handle adversity the best. You know, everyone's going to make mistakes. Everyone's going to fail. Everyone's going to have adversity. But I think it's the ones that can turn it around the fastest. And I think, you know, you just get back to work. All the lessons of losing bad losses in the juniors, you get back to work and you refocus. And I remember I was really tight that second week in that first round match because I knew if I lost, I think I was going into the qualifying of the third week. This is before they had futures. You built up circuit points. And so I remember being really tight that next match. But as you all know, as soon as you win a couple matches, you start to get the confidence, you start to feel a little bit better. And that's pretty much what happened is you start stringing those matches together and you get on little win streaks and then you start to believe in yourself again.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Hey everyone, you're listening to an episode with Jeff Salzenstein as he tells us what it was like to crack the top 100 at the age of 30. Keep listening for more. All right, it's a good lesson to actually apply to pretty much everyone in any kind of field and every kind of sport. But let's fast forward a little bit. You go through a couple of years on tour, you go through these injuries, you go way past the 3 years that you initially planned on. And then at the age of 30, in 2004, you crack the top 100 by reaching exactly number 100 for exactly 1 week. Mm-hmm. So now you can always say you're top 100. I mean, imagine if it was 101.
That's right.
What did this mean to you?
Well, the funny thing too is I think on Wikipedia for a while, I don't know if it's changed because, you know, someone can go in and edit those things. I think it said my career high was like 91 in the world. So people wouldn't start to announce that. And I would look at them like, okay, if you want to say I was 91, but I was really 100. My journey to the top 100 was, I mean, I think it was very, very interesting, you know, all the ups and downs. And before I share that experience real quickly, I want to touch on probably one of the most pivotal moments in my career. And it's usually where I start a lot of podcasts or interviews. It was, my match with Michael Chang at the US Open. So I was 16 months into my pro career. That second year, I was about 140 in the world. I'd gotten a wild card into the US Open. I beat Michael Teelstrom in the first round. I think he's about 60 in the world. And I'm playing Michael Chang on stadium court. He's number two in the world. And I remember I had 20 people in the box, my family, my friends, my fraternity brothers from Stanford, my ex-girlfriend who now wanted to be my girlfriend again because I was playing Michael Chang at the US Open. You know, a lot of stuff happening in New York, 1997, back in the day. And I remember winning that first set. I hit a, you know, I'm a lefty. I hit a wide slice. I come in, I hit a backhand angle volley to win the first set. And I had this smile on my face, like, oh my gosh, I've arrived type of thing. But I always tell people that's when the match ended. And they look at me like, what do you mean that's when the match ended? And the match ended because the anxiety and the self-belief around that, basically the dominant thought in my head during that match or leading up to that match that day was, hey, whatever you do, don't embarrass yourself in front of the world tonight, which we all know is flawed thinking. It's limited thinking. And I didn't really have anyone to help me kind of check that. These were the silent thoughts and the demons inside my head. So I win the first set and then I lose the next three sets. And everyone, you know, thought I played a great match. I was on my way to the top 50. The next day I signed with Pete Sampras's agent, Jeff Schwartz. And I remember just after that moment, putting so much pressure on myself to break the top 100 and to keep going and to be one of the next great Americans or whatever they do when they pump people up. And so 3 months after that match, I had pain in my ankle in the off season, and it was misdiagnosed for 8 months. Finally ended up having surgery on my ankle. 6 months after that, I hurt my knee in my first tournament back at the Miami Open, and I had another knee surgery. So within 2 years, I had two surgeries, and I lost my ranking. My protected ranking had dropped to like 360, and I was essentially starting over at 26 years old. And so, but it was during that time that I started delving into all things high performance. I went to my first yoga class. I started studying organic food. I started drinking green drinks. I was in the locker room drinking green drinks at 26, 27 years old, and everyone was looking at me like I was a nut. And now that's like normal.
Normal. That's
so
normal.
I was doing all the weird stuff 20 years ago. Now it's mainstream. And, but that was the pivotal moment that changed me because I was like, how can my body be breaking down at 24 years old? I've got to figure this out. So I studied natural healing. I got into acupuncture. I went to chiropractors. I drank alkaline water. I did all of it. You name it. I was testing everything. I did all the crazy diets. And so that really shaped me, shaped my career as a player, but then also as a coach and now all the things that I'm doing online as well. And so that really set the stage for, you know, 28 years old. I moved to Atlanta, worked with a coach there for a couple of years who showed me some secrets that I hadn't learned before. And I remember I was about to crack the top 100 and I got to the semis of a challenger in Calabasas, California. And I'm in the semis and I'm playing a guy by the name Ivo Karlovich. At the time he's about 24. He's like 45 now. He's still playing. And he was just starting to break through. And I'm playing in the challenger and the ball's bouncing over my head. And I lose 6-4, but then I flew to León, Mexico. And it was back in Mexico where I won that challenger. And that was the match when I won in León at this 50,000 challenger that got me to break the top 100 and also got me main draw into Wimbledon. And so I think I was in the top 100 for a couple of weeks for, you know, a cup of coffee. And then I moved back down a little bit. But yeah, it was been a crazy journey. One that I would not change for anything because of all the lessons that have been learned. And I like to think it made me a better coach because of everything that I went through in my 20s as a player.
That is such a good story and so many ups and downs, but you mentioned the top 100 and you mentioned being, you know, introduced as top 100. How would your life be different if it was like 101? Would you be top 200, top 150? Like, what would you classify yourself?
Maybe I just, in the marketing, I'd probably just say, you know, top 101 and kind of make a joke out of it, right? I don't know probably top 150, but yeah, I mean, maybe I would put a hook in there and say, yeah, I'm one of the best, I was top 102 in the world. And people would be like, 102, what do you mean? So I probably try to find some angle with it. But yeah, I mean, I think now looking back again on my career, and now I can kind of use that with my marketing, it's definitely a nice touch that I was top 100 in singles and doubles.
That is a very nice touch. I mean, not a lot of people can say that. People, right, all the time, I know that I've talked to many people in my lifetime. When you tell them, oh yeah, I was top 100, they just assume that it's just a casual thing, that's not a big deal. But if you ask them, if they're a lawyer or something, oh, are you the top 100th lawyer in the world? Yeah, so pat yourself on the back, Jeff.
Thank you. Oh, I definitely, I pat myself on the back. What I also get a kick out of, and you were already alluding to it, is that, you know, the top 100 at the time that I broke the top 100, I was the 10th highest ranked American. And, you know, at that time, I think it was, I don't know if Agassi was still, you know, Agassi might've just retired, but you know, you have Roddick, you had Dent, you had Gamble, you had Gimel, like James Blake, like that whole crew. And so, you know, I'm 10th in the whole country. Like, you know, that's like, if I was 10th in Major League Baseball or 10th mm-hmm. in basketball or even 100 in basketball, mm-hmm. you know, I'd be making $10 million a year and everything would be paid for. And I'd have my whole own team and physio. Like people just, the regular folk, as you know, they don't understand the business model that is flawed in pro tennis, how good top 100. I mean, people understand, I think people in the know understand how good 100 is. But I don't think they realize, you know, how tough it is to get there, how tough it is to stay there, how tough it is to make a living, all the things that come with it. So you definitely have to love the sport. You have to love learning. You have to love the kind of the mentality of seeing how good you can be at something, because it's a bit of a trap. It's a bit of a trap that you're on this journey thinking you can maybe get to 75 or 50 or 20 or whatever that level is. And it's kind of that never ending cycle. And so obviously, as you all know, it's very important to have a strong support system and the right information to help you get to that next level. And that's sometimes hard to find.
It is. It is. How did you transition, though, from this playing career being around the 100 at 30 and then retiring at 33 not that long after?
Sure. So, you know, in full transparency, I turned 30. I qualified at the U.S. Open a few months before my 30th birthday. So I was 29. I qualified there. I broke the top 100, you know, 6 months later after the age of 30. You know, the next 3 years, I had big aspirations, you know, of the next level because my body was feeling better than ever. I was learning all these cool things now. And by the way, 29 then was kind of considered old to qualify at the U.S. Open at 29. Now you're like a rookie if you qualify at 29. I mean, it's unbelievable how the longevity and the careers have developed. When I see these guys that are in their late 30s and even 40s still out there, it's truly remarkable. Shows what's possible, what the human body can create. But I would say from 30 to 33, I struggled. You know, I still was getting these nagging injuries. I had a lot of foot issues. You know, I didn't have a full-time coach. I had a part-time coach. I was just trying to find my way still. And so again, I think that's what helped me become a good coach early, because I almost had to coach myself. I had to figure out things the hard way. So now when I'm working with a player, it's like, oh, it's like, just do this. And then it's like fixed in 5 minutes when it took me like 10 years. But I'm 33 years old. I was actually having some health issues. In full transparency, I was feeling lightheaded. My energy was off. And I really think, maybe to get a little woo-woo here, but I don't think I was aligned with my purpose or what I was supposed to do with my life. I wasn't feeling very fulfilled kind of chasing the rankings and the tour. And so I honestly think I kind of worked with the stress of it all. I kind of worked myself into an imbalance with my health. So I wasn't feeling great. And I had a family member and a half brother who was having addiction issues. And I actually kind of witnessed it firsthand. He lived in Florida at the time. He's much younger than I am. And when I saw him struggling, it was actually a pretty traumatic event. When I saw him struggling, I was like, I got to do something. So it was almost like I couldn't quit the tour until something major happened like that. And so I literally, like snap of a finger, helped my brother out, moved back to Denver. Again, I didn't really know where to go. Like, what do I do? I need to coach. I need to make some money right away. I was helping out a family member. And that's why I moved back to Denver. And I just started coaching and I just started grinding just like I did as a player. And just one step at a time, you know, one lesson at a time, one day at a time. And that was like 2008. And about 2009, 10, me being the curious type, I think that's what's kind of propelled me to do the next thing. I started studying online marketing. I came across these guys that were talking about how you could build an online business leveraging your expertise. And I was like, well, I know a little something about tennis. So I started studying when I wasn't coaching, teaching tennis in Denver, I started studying online marketing and I created my first blog. And then I learned how to create a product. I learned how to do email marketing. And so I just put my entrepreneur hat on and just one step at a time. And that's kind of how it transitioned from player to high performance junior coach in Denver. And I had 20 or 25 players and helping them out. And then when I started launching these products and things took off, you know, 7-8 years ago, that's when I started moving more towards full-time online with Tennis Evolution.
Hey, everybody, you're listening to the Tennis.com podcast with special guest Jeff Salzenstein. He's telling us how he started his platform, Tennis Evolution, in 2010. Keep listening.
And that was YouTube videos. So you make these different videos that people can watch and learn tennis from online. And you did this 10 years before COVID.
I did. And what's so funny is I'm so passionate about nutrition. So that was the thing that I was really into. And I remember thinking that that's what I was going to be making videos about. And if someone wants to go into the deep recesses of the YouTube and they want to Google my name and type in the word blueberry or the word avocado, they will find videos of me sitting at my desk in 2009 or 10 talking about the value of blueberries and avocados. And I quickly realized after doing that, that I probably should stick to my strengths and get back on the court again. So it's pretty funny, you know, people might see Tennis Evolution and say, oh man, he's, you know, whatever, he's kind of got this going on and he's been doing it a while. He's got all these products and it looks really clean or whatever. But I started with no business plan. I started with no clue. I was making blueberry and avocado videos with no microphone. Like there was a lot of stuff going on that I was clueless. And so if anybody has a dream or a passion to start something, that is the key. You just have to start and you just have to get going and just take one step at a time. And so, yeah, I launched my first course at the end of 2011. And it's so funny to see how the online market has evolved. And at that time, I was actually there. I wasn't the first. There were probably three or four other guys doing this. And now every Tom, Dick, and Harry makes, you know, tennis instruction videos. So, you know, pretty crowded market, but everything is crowded these days. So the key is figuring out how you can make yourself stand out, how you can create a unique hook or big idea that people want to listen to you, because the YouTube videos, like you said, I started the channel in like 2010. You're just trying to get attention and get people to actually watch your stuff and say, oh, wow, he kind of knows what he's talking about. And so my philosophy with the videos has always been to try to keep the videos as short as possible, but still explain it in a comprehensive way and to get right to the point. If it's not simple, then you probably don't have it down yet. And so I like to think that I've been practicing communication for many years. I've always been fascinated by words and communication. So getting in front of the camera and practicing and making these tutorials has been something I've been very passionate about. Honestly, I would make YouTube videos 3 to 5 minutes long, but the algorithm says it's better to make them 8 to 12 minutes long. So I actually do stretch them out because it apparently helps the channel. But I like to give the tips, get right to the point. Not a lot of fluff, just teach the concept and try to show my passion, have my passion come through in the videos.
That's really awesome. Did you notice a spike during the COVID times of people watching more of these videos?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, the world had to adjust. The world is still adjusting. And, you know, I knew 9 years ago, this is where it was headed. And I think, again, I think that's probably maybe one of my strengths as I kind of see trends and patterns ahead of time. Yeah. I mean, I had a sense this is where it was headed. and I could see it more and more. And what COVID did is it just accelerated things by 10x. It actually forced people's hands to do this. But yeah, I mean, I've been doing Zoom calls and other, you know, creating digital content for all these years. So this is the way of the world. And, you know, ironically, maybe it's not ironic. I started my website. It was Jeff Salzenstein Tennis. And I did that originally just because of kind of the name recognition to get it out there. But I realized in about 2015, I said, well, if I ever decide to sell what I'm doing, or if I ever want to bring other coaches into the mix, I've got to change the name because I don't want my name on it. And so I changed to Tennis Evolution, but it is true. If you're not evolving and trying to stay ahead of the curve, you're going to be left behind. And that's in everything. You know, that's whether you're a pro tennis player. If you're not getting 3 to 5% better every year, you're falling behind. If you're not taking care of your health in a very progressive way, it's going to catch up to you. If you're just teaching tennis and relying on that income, without thinking about the digital side of things, you could get yourself into, you know, some challenging situations. So, yeah, I've always tried to kind of evolve and stay ahead of the curve. Let me finish with two things. One is, you know, my passion, besides tennis is performance. So I've been studying performance, nutrition, mindset, injury prevention. I've been studying this for 20 years because, you know, I've lived it. And so the next frontier for me is executive coaching, working with people outside of tennis. And I do have a client now in the finance space that I'm working with. And so that kind of performance coach, you know, being successful, but also being fulfilled, you know, you all probably have seen a lot of tennis players that are very successful, but they're not that happy. If anyone listens to this and they resonate with what I talked about, they can reach out to me at jeff@tennisevolution.com, or if they want to follow my tennis videos, they can go to Tennis Evolution or to my YouTube channel. So you guys are awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thanks for taking the time, Jeff.
Sure. It's been great. From the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, this has been the Tennis.com Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay caught up as we bring you new episodes every week. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app, as well as tennis.com/podcasts. You can also watch the videos of our episodes on Tennis Channel's YouTube page and tennis.com's Facebook page. We're your hosts, Nina Pantic and Irina Falcone. We'd like to thank our editor and audio designer and video editor, Christina Koseva, as well as the entire Tennis Channel team for their support. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.